This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You want to know where this economy's going? Well, stick around. We'll tell you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 7th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The big economic news of the week is going to be upon us Thursday morning. The latest reading on the Consumer Price Index, inflation for you and for me. It's high, as we know, maybe going higher, maybe not. We just don't know that yet. You know who does know, though? The bond market. While we wait for a whole slew of key economic indicators to get back to where they were in the before times, the number of jobs in this economy, for instance, the unemployment rate, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note got there this past Friday, topping 1.9%, where we had not seen it since late 2019. So we asked Marketplace Justin Ho what the bond market is telling us about this economy now and in the longer term.
For one, the rising 10-year Treasury yield tells us that the economy is improving. Winnie Caesar is global head of strategy at CreditSights. She says that improvement comes with side effects.
Inflation expectations are also higher than they had been last year.
Those inflation expectations have the Federal Reserve planning to raise short-term interest rates several times over the next 18 months, as it has after other recessions.
And when you look at those averaging out over time, they will come very close to, if not equal, the yield on the 10-year Treasury.
That's Jim Vogel, debt strategist at FHN Financial Capital Markets. He says the higher 10-year rate also reflects a bet that economic growth will continue.
People are looking at potential growth over the next couple of years, and if anything, they see it going higher rather than lower.
Even though the 10-year yield is rising, it's still only around 2%. That means the market doesn't expect inflation to last forever, says Kathy Jones, fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab, a current Marketplace underwriter.
If the collective wisdom of the market were that inflation was going to stay at 5, 6, 7% for 10 years, those 10-year yields would be much, much higher.
Jones says these are all educated guesses based on what we know today. And the interest rate on the 10-year T-note can only give us a wide-angle view of where the economy's headed.
It may not tell you much about what any individual's prospects are, or even collectively, much beyond that the expectations are for growth in the economy in very broad and general terms.
If fiscal or monetary policy changes, Jones says the 10-year interest rate could change too. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all bonds, people, I'm telling you, all bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The CEO of Spotify, Daniel Ek, emailed employees yesterday saying he is deeply sorry for the way the Joe Rogan Experience controversy continues to impact each of you. Those are his words, obviously. And he went on, Rogan's comments, including, as we learned this weekend, repeated use of the N-word, do not, quote, represent the values of this company. Rogan is staying at Spotify. The company has made that much clear. What Ek does have some cause to be worried about, though, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, is that employees might not stay.
That Spotify apologized to staff in this case instead of making a broader public statement was intentional, says Adam Galinsky at Columbia Business School.
Spotify's much more worried about employees leaving than subscribers leaving.
He says Spotify might not have a whole lot of competition as a product, but as an employer of tech workers?
This is an opportunity for organizations that want to steal these people to offer them a better alternative.
For many, that's a workplace that reflects their values. That's kind of new, says Brian Kropp, who heads HR research at consulting firm Gartner.
Employees used to say, that's the company I happen to work for, and if they happen to do good or bad things, that's about the company, not about me.
Now, though, Gartner research finds 70% of workers want their employer to take a stand on social or political issues, or at least explain their decisions, says Kropp.
They're dramatically less likely to get so frustrated with you that they quit, or tell their friends not to work there, or complain to customers, or whatever it might be.
Kropp says the pandemic has driven more people to find greater meaning in their work, and it's pushed more companies to brand themselves as socially responsible, says Daniel Korshan, a marketing professor at Drexel University.
These expectations are just like notching up and up and up and up, and it's getting harder and harder for companies to respond to them.
Especially when there's a conflict between what some of a company's consumers want in, say, a hit podcast versus what its employees want. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Some not great news today out of Team USA at the Winter Olympics in Beijing. American figure skater Vincent Zhou has pulled out of the men's singles competition after testing positive. So far, more than 150 athletes and team officials have tested positive. That is despite the silos and the bubbles and the closed loops that everybody Olympics affiliated are in over there. China, of course, has had a whole lot of practice in actively trying to contain this virus. Zero COVID, as Beijing's policy is known. It is one thing to know that, though. It is entirely another to live it. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak tells the tale.
When my parents dropped me off at the Calgary airport last month, it felt like a triumph.
Take care, Mom. Okay,
I'd gone home to visit my family and avoided catching the coronavirus. But if I had caught it, even if I'd recovered, Chinese authorities wouldn't have allowed me to return for at least a few months.
Toronto and
Shanghai?
Yes. Okay.
Then at the check-in counter, bad news. My flight is delayed and I'll miss the connection to Shanghai. There's another one the next day, which in the before times might just be annoying, but with China's zero COVID policy, a flight delay is a nightmare.
But then my test, I wouldn't be...
Test is okay. The test we
All my COVID test results as the airline will still be valid for them, but not for the Chinese consulate, who I need permission from to fly. So I retook the test and prayed that the results will be ready in time.
It's 12:30 and my stomach is still in knots. Am I going to get on the plane tomorrow? I just don't know.
Hi there.
Hi.
Lower your mask for me, please. Perfect. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
I did make the flight. China's zero COVID policy has kept infections low. It's allowed Chinese factories to keep churning out all the things you've been buying online when most of the world was shut down. But this comes at great personal cost. Wu Fenghe sells engine oil to car garages. Last August, he says, he suddenly wasn't allowed to leave his home.
My area was in lockdown for over 15 days from a small outbreak. I had no income. I couldn't go out to sell or deliver products.
Still, he says he supports the strict measures, and there is widespread public support, though that's changing in areas like Reili, which borders Myanmar. The city has had what feels like a non-stop lockdown, says resident Deng.
At the start of the pandemic, people supported the prevention measures. But after so many lockdowns, residents are starting to resist. The economic loss they've suffered is too high.
She only gave her last name out of fear. She's been censored for speaking out before. I arrived in Shanghai feeling lucky. China has been suspending more flights from Canada and the U.S., citing COVID prevention. The U.S. Department of Transportation has retaliated, and so there are basically no direct flights from the U.S. to China now. China's zero COVID policy can be draconian. Last December, the northwestern city of Xi'an went into lockdown. A video taken by a bystander shows a heavily pregnant resident outside the hospital. She was bleeding, but was turned away because of COVID protocols and suffered a miscarriage.
Please adjust position and face the camera.
Back in Shanghai, I passed the facial scan at immigration, but then I'm reminded that the U.S. and China are still in a trade war. Three officers took turns to check my paperwork. They seemed unsure whether U.S. media journalists can re-enter China. I got through. And despite being vaccinated, the rules are the same for everyone entering China. Quarantine for 14 days in a government hotel, plus whatever your destination city requires. Shanghai, where I live, is usually measured, but has now stepped up its prevention measures. On day four, a woman in a hazmat suit did my COVID test, or PCR, which consisted of one swab each for the mouth and nose. But by day 14, Omicron was detected on the mainland, and the PCR got amped up. It was two nose swabs, two in the mouth, plus the doorknob, my pillow, and cell phone were swabbed for COVID. Once they all tested negative, I was released from the hotel. A man in a hazmat suit followed behind, spraying disinfectant on every surface I touched as I left. They sent me home, but with new rules. Don't go outside for another week. Two antigen tests, nine PCRs, and 21 days of quarantine later, I'm finally free. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
I'll tell you what, Jennifer's Instagram about that quarantine period, it was pretty good, I'll tell you. Anyway, coming up.
After the recruiting process, I received 7 offers.
Well, that's nice. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's basically flat today, 35,091. The NASDAQ down 82 points, more than 0.5%. Landed at 14,015. S&P 500 shed 16 points, 0.3%. 44.83. Spirit Airlines were up 17.1% today after Frontier announced it would merge with its fellow low-cost carrier. Deal is worth $6.6 billion all in. That's debt included. Would create the fifth largest airline in the country. Southwest moved up 2.1%. JetBlue improved almost 3.6%. Fitness equipment firm Peloton, it of the oh-so-troubled recent past, jumped almost 21% after reports that Nike and Amazon are apparently interested in buying it. Nike ran down 0.1%, ran down, Nike, get it? Amazon added almost 0.2%. So the story of the day, really, bonds yield on the 10-year Treasury, 1.92%, back where it was in the before times. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, let's talk power grids here, shall we? The actual grids, the transmission lines that get power from wherever and however it's generated to the substation that eventually gets it to you and the light switch in your living room. Increasingly, that power is being generated by renewables, wind and hydropower, and more, solar. But also increasingly, those renewable power sources are having trouble connecting to the grid. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on that.
As the cost of solar, wind, and battery storage have fallen, and with the help of incentives and mandates, the number of proposed renewable energy projects has exploded. And everyone wants permission to connect to the grid at the same time. Wait times have crept up to 3.5 years, according to research by Joe Rand at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab.
The interconnection queue and the interconnection study process has become a major barrier to clean energy projects getting in the ground.
Part of the problem, according to the Solar Energy Industries Association, is just inefficiency.
Effectively, right now, we have a process that is broken.
Giselle Ray directs regulatory affairs at SEIA.
We see a continual back and forth with grid operators. There's no really streamlined process on how to do this.
And many projects don't ever actually make it, says Rand.
Historically, roughly 25% of these proposed projects ultimately, get built.
One of the problems comes down to logistics. So, for example, if you want to build a solar plant far from a transmission line, the hookup is going to be super expensive and might get the project denied. Or if you are going to build a wind farm right next to a transmission line, but that line can't handle any more power, the project's not going to work out. One might think that information would be available to developers ahead of time, but Rand says it's often not.
To some degree, they may be entering these queues to get some information as to the cost of that interconnection.
The fact they have to do that suggests grids are not prepared for the tidal wave of renewable energy coming their way.
Long-term transmission planning is not adequate.
He and others say grid operators need to get better at planning, planning to expand the grid to make room for renewables, and planning to help connect them at all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, I happened upon a Twitter thread from an elementary school principal talking about what his day-to-day in these pandemic times is like, trying to run a school with teachers and staff and students testing positive and unable to actually come to school. Greg Moffitt is the principal in question. He's at Fairmont Charter Elementary, and the Twitter thread in question now has more than 20,000 likes, which, for those who are unfamiliar, for an elementary school principal from Northern California, is a whole lot. So we have gotten him on the phone. Mr. Moffitt, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Kai. It's great to be here.
So I talked about your Twitter thread up there in the introduction. So the first question obviously has to be, what was it like when you woke up this morning? What were you facing?
Today, I got to be in the crosswalk, and I've been out at recess supporting kids there. I don't have to cover any classrooms today. We managed to get subs for all of our teachers, and in between that, I'm checking in on kids, talking with parents, just doing the job.
Let's talk about some of the environmentals for you and for all school administrators across this country. First of all, at the district level, you're getting the support you need. Are there finances available for you? Those kinds of sort of educational infrastructure things?
I work in an incredible school district, and our district office staff, when we don't have a sub, when we don't have a staff member here, they come on out. They are here on our campus being paraeducators and student monitors and crossing guards and classroom teachers. So we do have a lot of money from the state and federal government. Our district alone has about $32 million to spend over the next few years. And we've spent about two-thirds of it. We still have another third left to go. But all of that money requires a plan. So I feel incredibly lucky by the district that I work in and the resources that we have.
What about the teachers at Fairmont Elementary? What really happens in the teachers' lounge, Mr. Moffitt?
You know, they laugh, they cry, they get frustrated. And I think we spend a lot of time thinking about how our kids are reacting and responding to this pandemic, but our staff are also living in the pandemic too, right? They're going through it. They have families. They have concerns. My job as a principal is to validate that and to see it and to help folks process. And I'm not sure I really sort of understood all that when this began two years ago. We were so focused on our kids, right? We were so focused on making sure they were okay. I have to spend as much time focusing on the staff to make sure that they are okay so that we can be there for the kids.
What's the community environment like? I mean, it can be fraught, right, with masks and absences and all of those things. What's it like for you?
You know, there's this quote by Dr. Michelle Borba, and she wrote this book on selfie, and she says that as anxiety goes up, empathy goes down. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are all facing lots of really anxious and worried people. We don't know what's going to come next. We don't know what new policy or new rule is going to come our way. And so everyone's emotions are at a heightened state right now. And so sometimes parents, sometimes teachers, sometimes kids, they unleash those emotions. I've been really, really lucky that folks are pretty understanding in our community. They want to keep everyone safe. They want to do the right thing. But definitely people don't all agree with what that is. You hope that people are respectful and civil, but that's really hard right now.
The school that he works at now is called Fairmont Elementary Charter School. It's up in Vacaville, California. Mr. Moffitt, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. I appreciate it.
At the risk of stating the obvious here, we are all a whole lot more supply chain aware than we were just a couple of years ago. And as we have talked about a bunch on this program, that has been a business opportunity for a whole lot of people and companies and institutions of higher education, too. The supply chain management major right now is hot. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher has that one.
Back in the 90s, Kelly Lynch worked in supply chain management for the automotive industry. And one night, watching TV with his wife, this episode of the show Friends caught his attention. It's the one where Rachel gets a job as an assistant buyer at Bloomingdale's.
Oh, it's going to be so great. I'm going to get to help decide what we sell. I'm going to have an office with walls and everything.
Lynch was skeptical. He knew that procurement takes more than a love of shopping.
And that was her motivation. Well, anybody can do this, right? And I kind of laughed, and I remember saying to my wife, if it was only that easy.
Lynch now teaches supply chain management at Michigan State University, which has one of the top programs in the country. He says applications are up by more than 10%.
We're attracting students who may have never thought of supply chain management.
Even undergrads. Last fall, for example, there were a lot of freshmen at the first meeting of the Student Supply Chain Association. MSU senior Kate Fairley is the club's VP.
I was able to really go around and be like, oh, nice to meet you. Do you need any food? Is this your first time?
Fairley says when the pandemic hit, suddenly there were real-time case studies to look at in class, from toilet paper to port slowdowns to transportation bottlenecks. And practically overnight, supply chain experts became sort of rock stars.
We've gotten a deluge of requests for insight and perspective.
Shea Scott directs the University of Tennessee's Global Supply Chain Institute. He says that's validating, but points out that the supply chain is complex.
And that doesn't always lend itself to a one-sentence soundbite.
Especially when you're trying to get up to speed on it quickly. At Arizona State University, Thomas Cole teaches his students that the supply chain is kind of like personal health.
You don't really notice an issue until you try to do something that you thought you could do, but you can't.
And the past couple of years have brought about all kinds of new challenges, from last mile delivery to environmental sustainability. Cole says consumer demand for greener products is something Arizona State students learn about in a class simulation about coffee. The exercise includes a challenge, customers rejecting the coffee because the bean growers are destroying the rainforest.
You're losing sales because of this. And the look on the students' faces, why is that my problem?
And that's the kind of thing that excites MSU senior Sydney Lintall.
You're always go, go, go and having to figure out or solve new problems because something always comes up. A shipment is wrong or things aren't working properly or you need to negotiate a new price with your supplier because prices have gone up or down.
Lintall already has a job lined up with a software company.
After the recruiting process, I received 7 offers.
Many of which pay well. Salaries in supply chain management are going up and already average $10,000 to $20,000 higher than entry-level positions in other fields. That's because, as Sydney Lintall found, companies want her skills. And so there are now more jobs for supply chain professionals than there are candidates. A classic supply and demand problem. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, which comes with this personal observation. Back when I used to get the paper copy of the Sunday New York Times, I always used to read the wedding announcements before the business pages, truth be told. It went front page, sports, weddings, and then late in the afternoon, business. Anyway, that is the anecdotal lead to this item from the Times the other day. There are going to be more weddings in this country this year than in any year since 1984. That is according to a trade group survey, yes, but still, 2.5 million weddings. That's a lot. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment, though, of economic context. From the Marketplace desk of, yeah, no joke, saw this in Bloomberg that just 25% of Americans say now is a good time to buy a house. That is an all-time low. And the data is from a monthly survey by the mortgage giant Fannie Mae, which one figures would know. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.